This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Hi, I'm Jay from San Diego.
I'm Chase from Seattle.
I'm Jamie from New York City.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy. Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jordan Morris. The influential punk band Red Cross was started in the late 70s by two brothers, neither of which were even old enough to drive. Their first gig was an opening slot for Black Flag, but the show wasn't in a punk club.
Eighth grade graduation party. I'm 11. He's 15. We're in this living room, you know, straight off like Freaks and Geeks or whatever. But, you know, so all these kids, you know, they're all like, you know, feathered hair, like feathered Roachcliffe earrings and puka shells. So they're expecting you to play a Foghat cover. And we played Who Are the Mystery Girls?
A New York Dolls cover. It's Bullseye. This week I sit in for Jesse Thorne and talk to Red Cross, the band that influenced genres from punk to grunge, about their influences from Deep Purple to Ziggy Stardust. And I ask where they disappeared to for almost a decade. Plus, Matt Bronger turns a minor argument with a friend into a serious comedy career. And Todd Barry delivers good news. Some household chores might be worth skipping for 10 years. All this on Bullseye. Each week on the show, we like to get pop culture recommendations from some people who we think have exquisite taste. This week, we are talking to Nathan Rabin and Scott Tobias. They are editors and writers over at theavclub.com. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Nathan, we'll start with you. Your pick this week, a new documentary, Queen of Versailles.
We saw Versailles, and we were inspired by the French architecture.
I drew it on the back of an envelope on my way to Las Vegas. In Las Vegas, we looked out our window, and we kind of copied the top three floors of the Paris Hotel. Probably should have used smaller envelopes because it turned out to be the largest home in America.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, The Queen of Versailles was a big hit at Sundance. I believe it won the directing award. And it is, it'd probably be unfair to call it a guilty pleasure, but it is a spectacularly enjoyable documentary about this couple named David and Jackie Siegel, who are sort of the epitome of nouveau riche. David is, I suppose, the most successful person at timeshares in the entire country. That's kind of his business, as his empire. He is the mogul of timeshares.
Does that still go on? Does timesharing still go on? That strikes me as such a kind of late 80s practice.
Well, funny that you mentioned that, because that is what a lot of the drama is about, is that he's extraordinarily successful for a long time. He becomes a billionaire. He kind of has this whole world that he kind of controls. So he decides, in an act of unbelievable hubris, that he will build the single largest single-family home in the entire country, a kind of a palace for his wife. And what happens is the recession. And people aren't buying timeshares anymore. And he goes from being a billionaire who controls this empire to being this guy who literally has to worry about keeping the lights on.
Nathan Rabin's pick this week, the documentary Queen of Versailles. Scott, let's move on to you. Your recommendations this week, two Blu-rays of classic films from the 40s, Force of Evil and Body and Soul. Tell us a little bit about them.
Okay, yeah, they're two films that are by Abraham Polanski. He wrote and got an Oscar nomination for Body and Soul, and he wrote and directed Force of Evil. And Polanski was somebody who landed on the blacklist just a few years after these films were made. These films were made in 1947 and 1948. And he was, you know, he was definitely a member of the Communist Party, was an unrepentant Marxist throughout his entire life. And the films, when you watch them today, really are a reflection of his political point of view. I mean, they're both noirs. You know, Body and Soul. They both star John Garfield. They're both noirs. Mm-hmm. The central theme of both is just money as being this corruptive power.
Today's winner's 114. I had a dime on 113, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
I nearly made 60 bucks, except for that one little digit. 600 to 1.
You're going to play 776 tomorrow?
No, 823. This morning, I nearly got hit by a car, and you know what the last number of the license was? 823. I figure if I live through today, it's my lucky number. Am I right, Mr. Morse?
If you don't get killed, it's a lucky day for anybody.
And from what I understand, these movies were big inspirations to Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, they were. Force of Evil, especially. The Blu-ray for Force of Evil has a Scorsese introduction. He's been stumping for this film from the beginning, because it's another one of those movies. It's 75 minutes long. I think it was pretty not terribly well received in the U.S., though in Europe it was celebrated.
Well, yeah, once again, Scott Tobias recommends Force of Evil and Body and Soul, two new Blu-rays out now. Nathan Rabin, Scott Tobias, thanks so much for being on Bullseye.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
You can find Nathan and Scott's writing and their podcast, Reasonable Discussions, over at theavclub.com. I'm Jordan Morris, in for Jesse Thorne. My guests are Jeff and Steve McDonald, brothers and founding members of the punk band Red Cross. They obsessed over music growing up, and in 1978, when Jeff wasn't even driving age and Steve was only 11, they started their own band. They were in the midst of a burgeoning LA punk scene that had bands like X, The Germs, and Black Flag. While Red Cross never reached huge commercial success, they found a cult following and influenced the punk and grunge movements alike. Their new album, the first in 15 years, is called Researching the Blues. Let's hear a little bit of the title track from that album. Jeff and Steve, welcome to Bullseye.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, thank you.
So let's talk about how the band started. I hear some accounts that the band started when you guys were like between 11 and 15 years old. Is that true?
Yeah, like
that's exactly true.
I was 14 when we first started writing our tune.
Okay, so even more exactly true, because Jeff was exactly in between 11 and 15. He was 14.
So,
I was 11.
And we had these neighbors next door who used to go to Hollywood. They were teenagers, and they had, you know, they liked Alice Cooper, New York Dolls, and all these groups that were now, you know, history has kind of rewritten itself, and people think that, oh, everyone had access to those records. Those records were complete. It was like pornography, essentially. And you couldn't find them in stores in the suburbs or anything. And so we got into that. And you know, when you're a little kid, you occasionally slip things in the cart, and your mom might find it. What is this? Put it back. I did that with Iggy Pop's Raw Power. Once.
Wow.
I found it at Ralph's in Westchester.
Yeah.
But I had to put it back.
Because there was contraband, too.
Yeah, we would have the eye for that. But I think when we were really into David Bowie very early on, we discovered Ziggy Stardust. And so I wanted to get all the records, all the earlier ones. And I remember going into Munt's City, which was a stereo shop that also sold records, and found a copy of Hunky Dory. And I remember this woman who looked kind of like, you know, like a Stevie Nicks. Maybe my mind has rewritten her image, but she was like looking at the album cover and just like, do you really want to know? You really want this? Have you ever heard this? And I was like 11.
Because we also were into like Deep Purple. We were into a lot of that. Like, you
liked long keyboard solos.
Yeah, into like a lot of 70s arena rock too.
Black Sabbath,
know?
Much more than Deep Purple. I mean,
as long
Deep
as
Purple
it had,
had
like,
its moments.
As long as it had a thick, chunky guitar sound, we were open to it.
But you had to deal with like 8-minute jams. And that's when punk rock came along, like the Ramones' first album. It was like, oh my god, looking at the vinyl, every song was like less than an inch thick, so it meant short, you know, running times, and it was there was no guitar solos.
Yeah, I mean that
it was
kind of
welcome.
You guys played some of your early shows with Black Flag.
Yeah.
At the time you guys were playing these shows, were they the Black Flag, or were they just a band from the neighborhood?
Well, they weren't neither. I mean, it was the same four guys. It was Keith, Greg, Chuck, and Robo. Actually, it wasn't even Chuck, because we all knew Chuck Tukowski as Gary.
Yeah,
Gary.
Gary McDaniels. Gary McDaniels.
The first show, technically the very first show, was at an eighth grade graduation party in Hawthorne, California.
This not thrown by the school.
No, it was thrown by Lisa Stengel.
Okay.
Check it out. Eighth grade graduation party. I'm 11. He's 15.
And it's in our neighborhood we don't relate to any of these people.
And we're in this living room, straight off like Freaks and Geeks or whatever. Mm-hmm. And
shag carpeting, maybe.
Oh, my God.
A lot of browns and
oranges. Or like Boogie Nights. So all these kids, they're all like, feathered hair and like feathered Roach Cliff, earrings and puka shells. And they're like watching us, like kind of stunned, like waiting for us to, so they're expecting you to play a Foghat cover.
Yeah.
So these guys wanted to hear Foghat. Maybe they expected you to.
They
bring
wanted to hear
a flute
Foghat, and we busted
Jethro
out.
Tull.
Yeah, and we played Who Are the Mystery Girls.
They were booing us right in our face. You suck. You suck. Very Bob Dylan 1966. And I would say, okay, yeah, well, we're going to play another song. It's like from from Black Sabbath bootleg, unreleased. All right. They'd fall for it. Boom. We'd play one of our, Annette's Got the Hits, one of our original songs. They'd get about 30 seconds into it. It's like,
this ain't Sabbath. This ain't Sabbath. This sucks. This ain't Sabbath.
Bullseye, I'm Jordan Morris in for Jesse Thorne. My guests are Jeff and Steve McDonald, who founded the punk band Red Cross as kids in the late 70s. The band's music was a touchstone for other musicians like Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth and Kurt Cobain. From their early album Born Innocent, here's an ode to Linda Blair. Listen to your guys' first albums, like alongside, a Germs album or a Circle Jerks album, like you guys do a lot more kind of shredding, and there is some kind of like jammy stuff in it.
Shredding?
Were you guys kind of trying something different stylistically, or did that just come natural?
Well, I'd like to answer this question.
Please.
Because this is very much a part of the core of who Red Cross is.
Yes.
I think at a certain point, we realized, punk rock was getting very uniform, oriented, formulaic, and a really kind of
regimented.
Yeah, and you couldn't, you're a rock star. That was like, the biggest insult, all that stuff. And then we
Keith Morris is still really like, that's literally like a cross to a vampire.
But anyway, so
Rockstar.
We realize, oh, wow, well, there's some new cool music, but we also love the stuff we had grown up with, Beatles, Stones, and Kiss. And what do you want to see when you go to a show? You know, you don't want your entrance blown, and you want this, like, excitement. And screw that. We want to be rock stars. We'd say it to their face. And we'd start creating a look on stage. We never paid attention to what was going on musically. We just did our own thing.
And we kind of probably paid a lot of dues for that too. You know, because we still get booked with bands like Circle Jerks and whoever, Black Flag. But often we go on stage and the crowd would just be like, I kind of irate, because we were kind of taunting them in a lot of ways.
It was fun though.
It was like someone who's used to abuse.
After a break, Steve and Jeff from Red Cross talk about their lost decade.
Our Atlantic deal only lasted for like a year, and then we lost that deal, and then we had like a stigma attached to us as far as the industry was concerned in the United States. And it's kind of hard to, you know, regain the trust or the support.
It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International.
Bullseye is supported in part by Squarespace 6, a site for creating a blog or portfolio with over 100 new templates and fonts using a drag-and-drop interface and scalable designs, offering a 24-hour support team. More at squarespace.com/bullseye. Hey, gang. The Max FunCon East lineup is posted right now on our website, maxfuncon.com. Want to spend the weekend with an Olympic pentathlete? You know you do. She might even share some of her secrets of success, like fencing really well. And how about stand-up comedy from Michael Ian Black? Yes, please. Want to take a class taught by Public Radio's Kurt Anderson? Uh-huh. But there's one guy that you absolutely cannot miss, talk show legend Dick Cavett. He'll be there, too. Max FunCon East is October 26th through the 28th in the Poconos. We'll have great sketch comedy from 10 West and Two Fun Men, a whole slew of classes to take you through the weekend, and tons of other stuff. The lineup is too long to list here, so go to our website, maxfuncon.com, and check it out. It'll be a truly amazing time. Registration is still open at maxfuncon.com.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jordan Morris, in for Jesse Thorne. My guests, Jeff and Steve McDonald, are founding members of the band Red Cross. The band is rooted in punk rock, but they've drawn on everything from the Partridge Family to the Beatles to Black Sabbath for inspiration. You guys had, you know, kind of maybe a little hit. Annie's Gone, is that off Third Eye? Am I wrong
guess
about that?
Yeah, in some circles it
charted in like yeah.
It was on 120
college.
Minutes.
Okay,
right.
Which was
right.
A big deal to me at that age. I mean, if something was on 120 minutes, it was automatically legit.
She couldn't ever be something that you couldn't see. She was always there right in your face.
The crazy thing is, like, we probably spent, like, you know, three times the amount of our most recent record recording budget on that one video. Or times the amount, even.
Yeah, was there ever a point where you guys thought this is it? Like, this song will put us over the top?
No.
We had no idea. There was no, like, really model for for our brand of underground music breaking into the mainstream at that point. And, you know, we just knew that we were built for big stages.
It was maybe a few years after that that you guys maybe started your hiatus. I don't know if that's the proper term, but what made you guys stop being Red Cross?
Well, that's not true. When we did our first like major label album on Atlantic, we toured for that. We did a little bit of a hiatus, but then we decided we wanted to be an international group. So we essentially spent the 90s abroad. I mean, we played in America, but we did not focus on it.
We dragged our ass up and down that clammy island known as the British Isles.
British Isles on Europe and Japan Australia.
Yeah, but the entire 90s, we got signed out of England because our Atlantic deal only lasted for like a year.
Yeah.
And then we lost that deal. And then we had like a stigma attached to us as far as the industry was concerned in the United States. And we had kind of lost the interest of the tastemakers on the underground because once you sort of like, you know, go for it, and very few people turn out to be Jane's Addiction or Guns N' Roses, and actually that transition actually works, and it's kind of hard to regain the trust or the support.
No, just the timing was bad too, because we did with Atlantic, we made our most subversive record out of our entire catalog.
Yeah, like it was so bubblegum and sweet that it was actually subversive.
It had nothing to do with trying to be Bon Jovi, who would have been the benchmark for someone going for a commercial success at the time.
Yeah,
that was in a weird lull. It was like very, very, very late 80s and then like the 91 Nirvana thing.
It was pre-Nirvana. So. It was kind of just post-Guns N' Roses.
It was kind
weird.
Of so hair weird. Metal pop it was a, period.
You know, by the time like 97, 98 rolled around, I was 30 years old and I had been doing it for 20 years and 31, 20 years. And for me, at least, we lost the drummer at that time. He like wanted to get into film scoring or something. And like, I just couldn't imagine like putting the band back together again and like starting it from the ground up and like trying to, you know, reinvent ourselves when I realized that I realized I had made sort of long-term career goal decisions before I had ever gone through puberty.
Yeah, Jeff, how about you? What did you do in that hiatus time?
Well, it's really strange because that like 97-ish period, those tours, most of them were out of the were in Europe and out of the country, so I was separated from my family a lot. And the one thing Red Cross is more than anything is a performance band. We're actually performance artists, and you know, you give 110%, and it's you know, you're giving your soul to the audience, but it's true. And then doing it every night for years and years and years, you just become depleted. And I had a child. I didn't give birth to the child. My wife Charlotte did.
You didn't?
But it was like she was two at this point, and I was just like, ugh. So for me, it was never like I want to not be in a band. I don't want to play music, but I just did stuff around the house, you know, raising a child and tinkering and doing little
things.
You
wanted to be like the John Lennon he had read about in rock bios.
Well, that's not really true.
Become the house dad after Sean was born.
Yeah, well, I was a house dad, and it just kind of did that stuff. And for me, it was really odd because everyone else in the band did, you know, continue to work in music and play live and work with other artists. And I never made a conscious decision not to play live.
Right.
But occasionally someone would ask me if I wanted to jam with them, and I would just say, oh, no. But I don't know why I said no. I guess I just kind of lost my nerve. So by the time we got back together for our first performance, it had been a decade with me not even stepping foot on a stage, which was odd because I'm kind of known as a performer.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jordan Morris, in for Jesse Thorne. My guests, Jeff and Steve McDonald, founded the influential punk band Red Cross in the late 70s. They were pop music and culture obsessed from an early age. Jeff's first concert was the Beatles at age 3, and put that obsession to good use in their music and live shows. Their new album is Researching the Blues. Make it new. Yeah, I want to talk about the sound of this new record, Researching the Blues. You guys talked about kind of getting away from that punk sound, and definitely in your kind of later music, you do. It does have a lot of that bubblegum and that kind of glam influence. But when I listen to this record, a lot of that kind of punk energy still seems to be there. I'm thinking specifically of the song Uglier, which really, you know, while maybe tempo-wise isn't a punk song, just kind of that, the energy of it really reminds me of that kind of early music.
I don't think we ever tried to get away from the punk thing. I mean, it's part of our foundation. When I said Beatles and Stones, that's like, you know, punk rock, everything, it's all been a part of everything we've ever done. We just kind of have veered off in different directions about how we want a record to be. But that song was kind of written in the, musically was written in the style of kind of a, it's kind of a garage punk, like 60s garage punk type riff, but we didn't want it to sound exactly like that. But that's the basic, what the music is like. And then I wrote that, most of that, then handed it over to Steve when we were recording, and he wrote the lyrics and finished it, sang it.
You know, I think a lot of our records would have actually kind of had this kind of finish to it, this kind of flavor, this aggressive guitar, this confident vocal, had we have the record making skills then that we have now. I think like a record like Third Eye, we always wanted it to have this kind of edge to it, but we weren't in control from a technical aspect of making the record. There was, I don't mean like from a corporate, there was no one like telling us we need a hit, kids. And then we worked with, you know, Desmond Child, but it was like, we would literally be in rooms with engineers and we'd be like, no, it's like the Beatles, but with Who Live at Lead guitar sound. And they would just look at us like, huh?
So when I worked with Peter Cetera,
they turn around and talk to us about Cetera.
So you had Peter Cetera's engineer. God, so funny.
Yeah, they turn around and talk to us about Cetera, and we just sit there with our mouth like, ugh.
Because all the bands I knew, you know, who'd make records, they would always complain like, oh, I hate the way the guitar sounds on my album. I told him that I wanted blah, blah, blah. It's always dealing with, like, the technical people and most musicians at the time. I think this new generation of Pro Tools and a digital age, everyone goes in the studio knowing more than
but like back in the generation before. But like back in the day, you play raw power for some engineer or producer in the studio, and you're like, that's the sound. And they're going to sit there and go like, I can't have a record that sounds like that on my resume, on my credits.
Oh, yeah. They probably would.
That's going to kill my career.
Yeah, God, I mean, the thing about Raw Power, the Iggy Pop song, is that it's a mess. Like, it sounds like a mess.
Yeah,
it sounds like it was done by amateurs.
Yeah, monkeys.
But I cannot imagine listening to that song
any other way.
Mm-hmm. Like, if you
remixed, and I actually like both mixes.
It's actually the whole album, Raw Power, is like that. It was, I think for a lot of musicians who discovered that record, it was just, you know, that was the beginning of lo-fi being like at an art form. Mm-hmm. Raw Power and the second Velvet Underground.
So before we go, I would like to play another track off this new album. But instead of me picking it, I maybe wanted to ask you guys, you were talking about kind of achieving this sound that is a combo between, you know, that studio pop polish and then that kind of garage rock aggression. Is there a particular song on the album that you think does that really well?
I don't Meet Frankenstein.
Let's try The New Temptations.
The New Temptations.
My guests on Bullseye have been Jeff and Steve McDonald. They are the founding members of Red Cross, who are back with their first full-length album in 15 years. It's called Researching the Blues. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bullseye, I'm Jordan Morris. It's easy to be annoyed with the people around you, right? So the one person you should be able to live with is yourself. But as Todd Berry tells it, living with yourself can be just as irritating.
A germaphobe. Also very lazy. It's a rough combination, lazy germaphobe. Because if the cleaning job's easy, like washing my hands, I do that compulsively, like 500 times a day. But if it's more difficult, like mopping my floor, I've never done that. I was rationalizing that, hey, I've only been walking around the same floor for 10 years. How dirty can it be? It's not a cleaning emergency like that time I accidentally touched my pinky against my belt buckle. That's a walk out of a wedding where I was the best man. Paralyzing being a germaphobe. Lots of places are really paralyzing to me. Laundromats have these baskets on wheels. Some guy will come in with a big bag of disgusting laundry, put it in the basket, move it into the washer. Then I'm supposed to take my clean laundry out of the dryer, put it in that exact same basket. It's like, I don't mind something having a dual purpose, but can't be like, hey, what's that big green box over there? Oh, that's a dumpster, and we also use that to store soup. Well, I think that might be an either-or situation. I'm a germaphobe, I have a short attention span. When I get movies on Netflix, I pick them almost exclusively by running time. I'm like, oh, I heard this is good. Oh, it ain't 2.5 hours worth of good. Let's see what Jim Belushi can slam out in 78 minutes. Dude keeps it tight. His movies have a wonderful economy of words. Went to a therapist in a rich area town here, and after the session, I go, what do I owe? He goes, oh, that'll be $400. And I just did that thing you do when you wander into the wrong furniture store. I'm like, how much is that couch? That's $27,000. Oh, does that come in red? Yeah, I'm asking a fake follow-up question. To give you the illusion I'm not mortified by what you just told me. And that I'm still in this conversation. But that's a good gig, Doc. $400 an hour for being sort of nice to sad people. Went to get a flu shot, went into the nurse's room, and she goes, can I get your last name? I go, it's Barry. She goes, Barry Manilow? And I gave her a little fake laugh, you know, because she hasn't torn up the open mic circuit like I have. There was a little pause, and she goes, "So what is your last name?" I go, "It really is Barry." Believe it or not, I wasn't setting you up for the worst joke I've ever heard in my life. Even if I had a contest where I only compared that joke to jokes that other nurses have told me, you'd come in last.
Todd Barry is a veteran stand-up comic. His new album, Super Crazy, is out now. After a break, Matt Bronger becomes a stand-up comic, kind of on a whim.
A friend who actually got me started, I said something evidently funny, and he was like, "Oh, that's great." And he was a stand-up, and he was like, "I'm going to use that." And I'm like, "No, that's my joke." And he's like, "You're not a comedian." I'm like, "I am now."
It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International.
Bullseye is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com. You can follow Bullseye on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/bullseye with Jesse Thorne and click like.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jordan Morris, sitting in for Jesse Thorne. My guest, Matt Bronger, is a stand-up comedian and actor who you might have caught on TV over the last few years. He was a cast member on Mad TV, he appeared on the late-night circuit, and he's got a recurring role on the NBC sitcom Up All Night, alongside Will Arnett and Christina Applegate. He's just released his second stand-up album and a DVD special called Shovel Fighter.
I am a master at saying the wrong thing to girls. Like, mwah, good. Like, black belt level, accidentally saying the wrong thing to girls. Like, I'll give you an example. A couple years ago, I used to live in Chicago, and I'm in a karaoke bar doing a stellar rendition of Oops, I Did It Again. Like, I nailed it. Like, I was Britney Spears. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was her. I was so good, minus the python. And I get off stage, and this girl comes up to me, right? She's like, "Hey, that was really funny. Hi, I'm Sarah." Comes up to me, gives me rhythm. And I could have said any number of things to make her like me or be my friend or maybe more, the night was young. But instead, what my brain told my mouth to say, what I literally said to a girl was, "Thanks a lot. Where do you live?" What the wah? Wah! What is the worst thing you can ever say to a girl? It's subtly awful. Look at how tall I am. In a crowded bar, I look like I'm trying to chew on girls' heads when I'm talking to them. "Hello. Ah. Where do you live? Where do you live?" I didn't say, "Oh, do you live around here? Are we neighbors?" That would have been fine. No, I said, "Where do you live? Where exactly do you live? What's the address? I'm going to hang out in the closet without a shirt and a Viking helmet. Is that cool?" Okay. No.
Matt Bronger, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Jordan. Thanks, man.
You grew up in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
And I know Portland kind of these days has a reputation for being kind of a respite for hippies. And that's kind of the reputation it has.
Sure.
Was that the environment you grew up in?
Yeah, well, I mean, now it's really cool. Now you go and there's 1,000 really cool restaurants and there's all these, you know, young people starting up these, you know, little companies like Rent My Bike for a half an hour and all this stuff. But like when I was a little kid, I was very hippie-ish.
You had to rent the bike for the whole hour as a kid.
The whole hour, and you had to pay in fresh basil. it's changed, but it also hasn't. Yeah, it's one of those things that I actually forget about the hippie element because it's like growing up there, I was just like, oh, most places have this. And it's like, if you go to most places, you'll be able to find a granola crunchy head shop, like somewhere. You know what I mean? There's just way more in Portland, I think.
So tell me about, you moved to Chicago after college to start performing.
Right.
Do you remember the first time you got up and did stand-up proper?
Yes. I went with a friend who actually got me started. And the way he got me started is he was one of those guys I waited tables with, and you know how you just riff around with friends, joke. And I said something evidently funny, and he was like, "Oh, that's great." And he was a stand-up, and he was like, "I'm going to use that." And I'm like, "No, that's my joke." And he's like, "You're not a comedian." I'm like, "I am now." Like, just so he wouldn't steal my joke, I started doing it. So I went to see him do a show, and it was like $5 to get in. And he knew the door guy. And then the promoter, the MC, she comes out. She's like, "Oh, are you Matt?" And I'm like, "Yeah." She's like, "Oh, Rob says you're really funny." I was like, "Oh, well, thanks." She's like, "Well, I'm missing a person. Do you want to go up? And I was like, I don't know. I don't have anything prepared. She's like, well, you wouldn't have to pay to get in, and you get like two free drinks. And I'm like, well, then that sounds fine. So they like, so I went in, and I remember sitting at the bar with a napkin and just writing a routine.
Right.
And I didn't, and I just went up, and it went great. But
did you read directly from the napkin?
No. Okay. I just kept it in my pocket. But I went up, and it went great, but it was like the audience was full of people that I waited tables with too. You know what I mean? So yeah, I kind of had a loaded deck. So, but it was good, and I went from there. And it was funny because it's like in a lot of comedic experiences like mine, when you have that first instance that's really good, and you're like, this is easy, and then the next five just suck. You're like, wait.
At what point did you move to L.A., and how close was this to you getting cast on Mad TV?
Hoy, I moved to L.A. in 2003. I got cast on Mad TV in 2008. Mm-hmm. 2008? Yeah, probably the beginning of 2008.
And did you get cast on Mad TV? I should say Mad TV, the semi-recently canceled but very long-running sketch comedy show on Fox. Mm. Did you find it as a stand-up? Does it go against your nature at all to work in that group environment of sketch comedy? Was that difficult at all?
No, because I starting out in plays and actually doing improv before I actually got into stand-up, you know, it's all teamwork. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think that the old improv of not going for the joke and not being the ham,
yeah,
because then you kind of – It stops there. You kind of want to help build everything. I think it's the same, very similar with sketch comedy. I mean, be funny where you're supposed to be funny, but at the same time, support the other people. Listen, you know? So, yeah, it was just fun. I mean, the thing about stand-up, I love it to death, but it is just you. And if, you know, you don't get a break in that hour and a half, whatever you're doing on stage, you know? So, you know, I kind of just am one who barrels through it. But, like, yeah, you know, and always make sure to have fun at it. But, like, it is also fun to be on stage with someone or, you know, on a set with someone and kind of toss the ball over, you know, to have a back and forth and watch them shine, you know. And it's a fun game to play with yourself where you're trying your damnedest not to laugh at something someone is just coming up with then or a new take on a line you've heard before. So, yeah, it's a good time.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jordan Morris in for Jesse Thorne. My guest, Matt Bronger, is a stand-up comedian and actor who you might know as the preppy neighbor dad, Gene, on the sitcom Up All Night. His new stand-up album and DVD is called Shovel Fighter. We're going to play a clip from your new album. It is called Panda Butler, and I have some questions, R.E. Panda Butler, after this.
Okay.
Asking the universe for something might work. So I'm going to try it right now. I'm going to try The Secret and see if it works, okay? So I am going to throw out right now what I want from the universe and hope that I get it. So here we go, okay? Panda butler! That's all I want. I want a panda that is also a butler. That's it. I want a panda that walks on his hind legs and often fails and tries to be my butler. Walks in while I'm watching TV with a tray of champagne flutes, which he will drop. Granted, he will drop them, but he'll try. Walks in. It's okay, Clive. You're still my man. High five. Actually, any bear that won't kill me. That's all I want, right? I will rubberize my home. You can wherever he wants, right? Just as long as he does. Like, can you imagine just sitting and watching TV with a bear that is also sitting and his little belly is going up and down with his breathing? His bear belly. You can put stuff on it, like a tray of cheese and crackers. And he occasionally just yells and you love it because it feels like commentary, right? You're right, dude. Jersey Shore is the end of all civilization. High five.
So it seems like your album has two kinds of jokes. The jokes fall into to one of two categories. Crazy imagination stories, like Panda Butler.
Sure.
And just really real blow-for-blow stories that actually happen to you. I mean, they really, really have the quality of your funniest friend cracking you up
in a bar.
Oh, thanks.
So it seems like there are these two things, these kind of crazy flights of fancy, but then this stuff that is very real, you know, without even a lot of writing. It's just recounting it. Does one of these come easier for you?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the stories, for sure. It wasn't any kind of planned thing. That's just kind of how, I don't know, I guess how my mind skews, because, you know, just the little facts you can just dig out and the way, I mean, I've always kind of been a storyteller, you know, ever since I was a kid, and it's fun to be able to kind of embellish these stories to make them funnier and things, you know. I'll draw the line at outright lying, you know, but it's like I will not exaggerate, but amplify, you know, a story.
Right.
So it has more weight, you know, and it's much more of an enjoyable thing. So when you're hearing the story, it's like, oh, it's an event, you know, mm-hmm. you know, because there's nothing like you bring up the party analogy. There's nothing like someone running in a room and going, holy crap, you guys, did you guys hear what happened to Steven? Like, what? Oh, let me get him. Steven comes in and tells a story. And it's just it's a moment, you know. So
yeah, it seems like kind of the benefit of having that be part of your act, and this is pure speculation on my part. Feel free to tell me that this is incorrect. But it seems like this kind of material you can just work out with friends at a bar. You don't have to go to a million open mics to get this right. Is that
well,
something that you do?
You'd think that, but it's like once you tell your friends a story, you've told it.
Right.
And I'm sure I could go around and make friends in bars and tell it, but it's like there's nothing like being on stage to get you better at being on stage and get you better at telling a story on stage, you know?
Yeah, I'm interested in the process of making a stand-up album. Like, how do you figure out what material goes on the album and what you save for your shows?
Well, I mean, it's you just put together the best hour you can. You know, you kind of sift through all your stuff. And you go, at least in my case, you go around, you ask friends, hey, is there something I did that you liked? Because I will just forget my bits. I have friends that have spreadsheets of all their jokes. I've never done that, mostly probably because I'm lazy, but also because I just don't like writing my stuff down. It's like I could have a 20-minute joke that will have two words, you know, on a piece of paper that will make, oh, that's that joke.
Panda Butler. For instance.
Yes, exactly. That, you know. And, you just put together as much good stuff as you can to fit that hour. And then you get an order together in terms of what flows well into what, you know. So.
Yeah. And is this a situation where your record company, I guess in this case, Comedy Central,
uh-huh.
do they give you a deadline? Like, we need the album by July 15th, or do you come to them and say, I'm ready to make an album?
Once you get a deal with them, I think it's – you kind of just set the date with them. It's not like you get a letter that's like, have it done by this time or else, because they come and they set up an engineer with you. They record it. They help promote it. In my case, I recorded at the Alberta Rose Theater in Northeast Portland, which is like three blocks away from where I grew up as a kid. When I was a kid, it was like an old rundown movie theater, and now it's like this really nice venue for – let's say like the lead singer of some rock band wants to go just do an acoustic set. That's where he would go in Portland, basically. So it's kind of this cool, like, intimate theater. It's maybe like 400 seats. And they came in and mic'd the whole theater, mic'd the audience area, and then, you know, tested it out. So it's got this really cool sound as well that I really like. But yeah.
Drinking comes up a lot on the album.
Sure.
There are a lot of hilarious drinking stories.
Mm-hmm.
And
thanks.
And you have a bit that really, really rang true for me about how different hangovers are in your 30s versus your 20s.
For sure.
And that's what it comes down to, like how hangovers are so bad for you because you eat the worst food for you to heal your hangover, right? That's some sick irony when you think about it. Like, you need something starchy or fatty or cheesy, you know, to heal yourself. And my thing is, I would get so drunk that my hangovers, I would get so drunk that I, like, it would be so hungover the next day that I couldn't decide on the cheesy, starchy, bad for me food, because deciding makes the hurdy brain hurtier. So I would just make up foodstuffs that don't exist and hope the waiter would just freestyle them up with the kitchen. Like, you know how a baby doesn't know how to talk, but it knows it wants milk, so it goes, ladder, ladder, ladder. Same kind of thing. Like, the waiter would come over and be like, all right, what do you have? And I'm like, just give me a plate of cheese babies and a hot boy. Yeah, whatever that is. I don't know what it is. Just make it. Just some cheese babies. Some babies made of cheese. Or some cheese buddies. Some cheese friends of mine. And a hot boy. I don't know what a hot boy... It's like a phyllo dough baby with hot dog veins. I don't know. Why are you making me make this up? My brain is on fire. No, come back. Come back. And some ham dancers. Yeah. Whatever those are. I need them. Like, just once I want the waiter to know exactly what I'm talking about, you know? Give me a plate of cheese babies. Yeah, you want a gang or a tribe? A tribe! And a hot boy. What do you want his mood to be like? Angry. No, melancholy. Melancholy hot boy.
Man, well, Matt Bronger, we're plumb out of time.
Okay.
It's been a damn pleasure
talking
to you.
Thank you so much for having me on, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, Shovel Fighter, you can get wherever finer records are sold. And if I am correct, there is actually a vinyl version of this comedy
album. Yes, I will always put out my albums on vinyl. It's on white vinyl.
Very collectible.
Which I think, like, a guy in the 70s would be like, it's the highest quality sound. Like, no, it's just white. That's all.
Every week on Bullseye, we close the show with a recommendation from our host. Today, that's me. Okay, well, I guess it's the Outshot. For one glorious month in 1997, my family had HBO. My parents quickly canceled the premium cable channel when they realized the sorts of saucy, adults-only programming that happened after midnight. But that month was enough for me to get acquainted with Tenacious D, the greatest band on earth.
Tenacious D!
Tenacious D was a late-night comedy show that followed the exploits of Jack Black and Kyle Gass. They played two overweight stoners named Jack Black and Kyle Gass, who just happened to be the world's greatest acoustic heavy metal duo. The show's plots were hilarious. The guys fought demons and found Bigfoot, but the really amazing part was the songs. They were hilarious, tonally perfect send-ups of rock and roll's conventions, from heavy metal's sexual bombast to punk's juvenile, non-specific hatred of authority. And the songs were funny, but where they succeeded was where most comedy music fails. They were really good songs. Kyle on lead guitar could write a truly tasty riff, and Jack Black can sing, like really sing. The D released a self-titled album and starred in their own movie, The Pick of Destiny, which had its moments but was mainly not good. After the movie bombed, the band went away. This year, they sort of unexpectedly came back with a new album, The Rise of the Phoenix, and it's the best music they've ever made.
When The Pick of Destiny was released, it was a bomb, and all the critics said that the D was done. The sun had set and the chapter had closed. But one thing no one thought about was the D would rise again, just like the phoenix. We'll puff and rise again. That's right, the phoenix. We'll rise again, yeah.
Rise is huge and rocking and totally hilarious. One song that sticks out for me is The Ballad of Hollywood Jack and the Rage Cage. Let me back up. In case you didn't know, between their movie bombing and now, Jack Black became Jack Black, the huge, famous movie star, and Kyle didn't. This song talks about how the resentment that grew between them tore the band apart, but the power of their friendship eventually brought them back together. It's funny and crazy and bombastic, but it's also honest.
No one respected him, baby.
if no one would represent Cage. Left on the streets of his dreams, he would cry in his rage for the stage.
This song really hit home for me. I turned 30 not too long ago, and I feel further away from some of my friends than I ever have in my life. Some of them have kids and houses and mortgages, and some of them still live in cramped apartments with three roommates. They're white-collar, blue-collar, starving artist, and everything in between, but the real friendships, especially those forged through creativity, endure. Jack might be a movie star and Kyle might not be, but when they're the D, they're the greatest band in the world.
In Hollywood, Jack got a message that Cage was in trouble. They sent Cage away cause he had gone completely insane. So Hollywood Jack jumped upon a jet plane and flew all that night through the rain to be with his friend and see what remained of his brain. Then Hollywood Jack told the doctors, you've got to retrieve him. You've got the technology, use the techniques of your trade. He grabbed their lapels and he screamed, by God, you must save him! Because your age, Cage, and I, can't you see that we're one and the same?
I'm Jordan Morris, and that's my Outshot.
Nothing and no one could harm the old Rage Cage again. Nothing and no one could harm the old Rage Cage again.
That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer, Julia Smith. Our editor, Nick White. Our interns, Lindsay Pavlis and Tom Pike. Our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Our theme music is Huddle Formation by The Go Team. Thanks to The Go Team and their label, Memphis Industries, for letting us use that. I'm Jordan Morris, and it's been a damn pleasure.
Bullseye is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology. Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. Whether you're planning a weekend away or an international adventure, All Trips Annual Travel Insurance can protect every trip you take for the next 365 days. Get a quote at allianztravelinsurance.com.
When voters talk during an election season, we listen. We ask questions, we follow up, and we bring you along to hear what we learned. Get closer to the issues, the people, and your vote at the NPR Elections Hub. Visit npr.org/elections.